here on FBH for a discussion by Dr. Peter Pellet. It's going to be about food, nutrition, and child health in Iraq.
Pellet, I've been talking to you, most of you are my students, and we were talking about this lecture, and I'm glad that now we are having it. Dr. Peter Pellet, Emeritus Professor of Nutrition in the University of Massachusetts. And Dr. Pellet started as a faculty in UMass since 1971. And before that, for 6 years, he taught at the American University of Beirut for about 6 years, right? Mm-hmm. And also, Dr. Pellet has spent he's a board member of the International Nutrition Foundation in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and a chief editor of the Journal of the Ecology of Food and Nutrition. Dr. Pellet also has undertaken international consultations on behalf of some international agencies like FAO, WHO, UNICEF, UNU, USAID, and USDA. Also, of course, mainly, focusing on Middle East and African countries. Since the imposition of the economic sanctions, Dr. Pellet has been a member and team leader of four FAO food and nutrition missions to Iraq. They happened in 1993, 1995, 1997, and 2000. Also, he was recently in Iraq, that's just this January 2003, as part of a team for the Center for Economic and Social Rights, which is in New York City. Also, Dr. Pellet has been head of nutrition research for many years, and of course has published about like 200 articles in books, book chapters, reports, journal articles, and reviews. And in the major areas, of course, of human protein and amino acid requirements, nutrition and development, and the determinants of nutritional status. So, as you also, most of you know, I have been Dr. Pellet's student for many years when I was at UMass completing my dissertation. He was the chair of my dissertation committee, and I'm honored actually to be his student for that many years. Now I'm very pleased to ask him to present us the lecture on food and nutrition and the Iraq War today.
Always feel embarrassed at hearing all this stuff that comes out from one CV, that you have to write it down. Actually, it's an awkward time to be talking about Iraq, as you're well aware. When Fatima asked me to do this, my first reaction, which was way back in January, was to say, no, I will not, particularly if we have gone through with invasion and all those things, I just wouldn't feel comfortable. However, I think I will, because I think the situation in relation to what is going to happen is still completely fluid. Just before I came, I checked on my computer, and I just want to read some headlines that are on the computer today in terms of the news there. Kurds occupy Kirkuk. Explain that a little later. Looters ransack Baghdad hospitals. Suicide bomb hits Marines. Shia leader killed in Najaf. Coup attempt in Cairo. Israel asks for Iraq-Jordan pipeline. And there is a report of a coup attempt in Cairo. Whether or not all those are factual, whether they will happen, it just shows the fluid nature of what is going on at the moment. I want to talk about nutrition. I want to talk about particularly the sanctions as they have functioned, because I think they're still highly important in relation to what is going to be happening. So if we could have the lights dimmed and the first slide, please. Just a title. Yeah, that's fine. You've got plenty of light back there and this last. Yes?
Is that good for everyone?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I have the control, don't I? That's right.
Yeah, you can also control it over there.
Oh. Okay, food, health, nutrition, and sanctions. This is a standard heading. What I want to do is to talk a little bit about some of the UN agencies, because the UN agencies in Iraq are a very special situation. There are the older agencies, the sort of real agencies that have been around a long time, such as FAO, Food and Agriculture, World Health Organization, and UNICEF. They have been in Iraq a long time, all the way through the development phase. World Food Programme really has only come in any big way, since the Oil for Food Programme has been established, and in fact has a very large part of its budget and its future is tied up in relation to the actions in Iraq. First, let's just have a look at some of the malnourished children. These are pictures that I've taken. These are not propaganda pictures from Uncle Saddam. These are in the pediatric hospital. Typical signs of marasmus, spindly legs, old man faces. Another one the same, the chest showing through, spindly legs again, old man faces once more. And we have malnourished mothers, generally with considerable degree of anemia, and undernourished infants. You can see the lip of the child here. We also have children that are very large numbers of children, very high birth rate in Iraq has taken place over the last number of years. More than half the population are less than 15 years of age. Large numbers of these kids, these were not ones that we weighed and measured, so we don't know how much underweight they are. But this is another family. This shows the sort of size. This is the local health worker down in the Basra region, and this is his family. Just shows you the number of children that are there and the huge population growth rate that is ongoing. This kid selling cigarettes or something in the street is actually 11. He looks about 7 years of age. We checked with his age from his ID card. And many of these children are out selling. They're often the only person in the family that is earning. And they sell things at the traffic lights. Before 1990, you never saw this in Iraq. You didn't see beggars on the streets. You didn't see this third world. See, any of you that have traveled in the third world, you know, whenever the car stops at the traffic light, there are people banging on the window trying to sell you things. That's Baghdad now, or not now. I don't know what's happening now. That was Baghdad not so very long ago. And this kid has probably not been receiving any education for quite a long time. So we've got a time bomb from the lack of education for large numbers that have taken place during this whole sanctions period. And it's important to remember, in relation to sanctions and food and nutrition, we have had, since the 986, that's the UN jargon for the Oil for Food Programme, we have had some improvement, and malnutrition rates have changed to some degree. Food availability certainly has improved. But in the main part of Iraq, up until a year or so ago, there was no real improvement in the malnutrition rates of children, despite the Oil for Food program, mainly because malnutrition in developing countries, and particularly in Iraq, is highly related to the water and sanitation situation, and that has not improved to any significant degree. And I'd just like to mention a quote here from 1968 from Scrimshaw, who, by the way, is still, if you've come across the name of Scrimshaw in your nutrition readings, and he is still active at the age of 86. He's in Kazakhstan at the moment, traveling around. He is the director of the project that we've got ongoing in Syria for lysine fortification, still amazingly active. And this is a quote that he made from an article written in 1968. If you get him in a corner, particular party, and say, Nevin, what is it you think that over your whole career, what's the thing that you think has been the most important? And he would say, well, it was that review on nutrition and infection in 1968. And here's a quote, the interactions of malnutrition and infection are synergistic. Infection is more likely to be responsible for nutritional disease than a shortage of food alone. And this was a sea change in the way that we look at malnutrition on a world basis. Previously, food supply was over here, infection was over there, no connection between them at all. The two are intimately related, and more malnutrition on a world basis relates to the water and sanitation situation than it does to the food supply as such. Here is a picture from Basra. I presume that that picture has gone by now, probably shot out by a passing tank. But interestingly, in the north of Iraq, Iraqis like to have a strong man and like to have a picture. I noticed, for example, when you go to the area in what was sometimes called Kurdistan, the three autonomous northern governorships, there will be the plinth like this still there. There won't be a picture of Saddam, but there'll be a picture of Barzani or Talibani or whoever is the local leader. They like to do it that way. Another important thing to recognize, this is a picture from 1993 down in the south again, a demolished tank, demolished in relation to depleted uranium. I just would like to mention as we're passing some of the perceptions that the Iraqis have. Now, whether these are perceptions are true or not is immaterial. This is the perception they have when you talk to them. They believe that many of their children are suffering from birth defects that are related to depleted uranium residues. Depleted uranium has been used in the current conflict and is going to be probably a problem further down the road. They also believe that the government of Iraq has been responsible for their food ration and for getting it through, which it has, in fact. And interestingly, it may be that through the foresight of the government, with the threat of invasion coming in October of last year, 2002, in October, they started allowing double rations. Double food rations were allocated to people so that there were stockpiles of food available in households. So perhaps the immediate problems that will occur with the food supply may not be as severe as they might be. On the other hand, with warehouses, at least one warehouse I know was not completely destroyed, but was certainly hit. The warehouse in Basra was hit, and I'll explain the awful food program in a little while. This also is another reason why the perceptions, this again is a picture from not as when it appears to be, it's only just happened. This is in Nasiriyah, which again is a town that we've been mentioning just a week or so ago. In Nasiriyah, this particular bridge is now a memorial. This is one that they claim that 400 people were on that bridge in 1991 when it was hit by a missile, and it has been set up as a memorial with a new bridge over here and a new bridge there. So all these things are perceptions of what has happened to them in relation to the United States. And they are not good. Maybe we've had some people waving flags in the last day or so. I'd wave flags if an invading army was coming around. I think there is a lot of distrust of the United States which is going to persist. Okay, this is the region, and I just want you to realize, I'm sure you do, just how central Iraq is in this Middle East. If this is going to be an occupied territory for time to come, and I don't believe any of the words that we're told about wanting democracy. I don't think the United States wants any democracy in the Middle East, because if it had democracy there, it would be an Islamic-leaning government that wouldn't be sympathetic with them anyway. But it is so central, and it was an artificial construct, amongst other people, Gertrude Bell in the 19th turn of the century and a bit afterwards drew a line in the sand and said this will be Iraq, and that was Iraq. Many, in fact most of the countries in this part here are not natural boundaries, they are constructs. Kuwait, for example, was set up by the Brits to be the largest territory it could be, or the smallest territory it could be, to cover the oil that was available. Was constructed to fit the oil supply that was there and then wasn't a real nation. This time, by the way, in January, I was able to fly into Baghdad. Previously, all the missions from 1990 onwards, you take the car across the desert, 12 hours by car across from Amman to here, Baghdad. Mosul in the north and Basra in the south. We'll talk about those a little later. Okay, now this is some data from 1960 to 2000. And what I want to show you from this is food supply data for Iraq and for the United States. I'm sure you've had mentioned food balance sheets. Food balance sheets are a very crude means of estimating food availability, but they are surprisingly accurate at giving a picture of what is going on in the general food supply. And we can see that from 1960 until 2000, or almost 2000, the United States has had a gradually increasing availability of food. It doesn't necessarily mean that everyone is consuming that, but more than enough at 3,000 calories back in 1960, now considerably more than enough in 1990-2000 or so, 3,600. This is the Iraqi situation. And in general, on a world basis, as countries get richer, their food availability increases. So back in the 1960s, oil was new. And by the way, my experiences from Iraq do go back to 1966. That was the first time I went there. When I first joined American University of Beirut in 1965, or actually it was 1965, not 66. I can't imagine it happening with a faculty appointment now. I was a new young faculty member. I said, well, your first semester, I don't think you need bother with any teaching this first semester. Be very useful to orient yourself to the region to see where we are, where our students come from. So, and there's plenty of travel money available, so why don't you arrange just to go around the region, meet up with the local institutes and see where we're at. That was wonderful. I had a great chance then to visit Iraq, Iran, Turkey, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, all around the region. And it was a wonderful experience to meet with these people that were, in fact, the mainstay of the students that came. We had them all over the region. Anyway, So that was my first time here. Iraq was just beginning to get the feel of its oil well then. But as you can see, as the country got richer, the food availability per capita increased from a little less than 2,000, 1,800 or so, to about 1980, when it was about 2,700. We then had the Iran-Iraq war. Food availability still went on, still increased, until when we get about 1985 or so, the food availability in Iraq was pretty close to the same as it was available here. When the sanctions were imposed, a very dramatic and rapid fall in food availability, from something in the order of 3,200 to 2,300, 400, slow decline. And then when the Oil for Food program, SCR 986, came along in 95, 96, and 97, an increase, and we're running at about 2,500 now. So a picture here showing increasing wealth, increasing food availability. And during that period, Iraqis were doing very well, were receiving a very adequate education system. Availability of university education was free for men and for women. The pharmacy school was 60% female in 1980 or so. And there was free health care, etc. So the country got richer, and some of its wealth did spread through to the ordinary people. I'd like here just to distinguish between, we use the phrase very widely, human rights. There really are two sets of human rights, of which the US believes in one set, and much of the rest of the world believes in the other set. The US believes in the human rights mainly dealing with the ability to have political protest. Much of the rest of the world believes that human rights include the social and economic rights, right to food, right to health care, right to development, etc., which we in the US do not recognize. And the institute and the group that I went to Iraq with in January, Center for Economic and Social Rights, is in fact centering its activities on these economic and social rights. Okay, over the period, another thing that is going to be very difficult, I think, in the coming future, is Iraq, during its oil wealth time, tended to neglect its agriculture and tended to import most of its food at one time. I think about then 80-odd% of food was all imported. But the agriculture situation is difficult and is probably not going to get better. Not many people are aware of this general fact, that if you look at the land area of Iraq as a whole and compare the land area in the three autonomous northern governments, what we would call the Kurdish area, the Kurdish area is only 9% of the land mass of Iraq as a whole, only 9%. But it has 48% of the agricultural productive land. The agricultural land is centered in the more hilly regions in the north, which have a better rainfall, better climate than in the main areas in the south, which are heavily based on sand and desert, yes?
So you mean the climate is different, not just the amount?
The climate is different. It's got better rainfall because it's up in the hills, etc., all sorts of things. Anyway, in the main part of Iraq, the land area has been declining, the yield has been declining, and with sanctions, there have been limitations in machinery, pumps, seeds, pesticides, herbicides, and agricultural production has, despite the efforts of food and agriculture organization, have tended to decline. Okay, I just want to mention something about the missions that I've been involved with since the sanctions. first one I was not involved with in 1991. It is called the Harvard Mission. This was a group of what were then Harvard students who associated with some medical people from the University of Jordan in Amman, and they organized, in a rather wonderful manner, bus trips and bus loads of students and doctors that left from Amman, went to Baghdad almost within a month of the actual fighting stopping, and did a large-scale nutrition survey throughout the whole country in order to gauge the effects on children of the war. So that was the Harvard mission. In 93, when FAO wanted to have its own mission, it wanted to have a sort of repeat or partial repeat of the Harvard mission. The government of Iraq had been very happy with the Harvard mission and they wanted it. Well, I think that's how I got involved, not because I was at Harvard, but because I was in Massachusetts and Harvard was in Massachusetts. But I found myself as a member of this group in 93 that then went to do a survey under FAO. We had another one in 95, and the 95 mission really did find severe malnutrition and I think was an important catalyst for the Oil for Food program. I think our data that came from the 95 report helped the acceptance of the Oil for Food program. In 96, the Harvard group, the people that had run it, including Sarah Zaidi, founded this Center for Economic and Social Rights, and they did their own survey. So there's a connection between this mission and the Economic and Social Rights group. We had another mission in 97, we had another mission in 2000, and then we had another CESR one in 2003 that has just taken place. The mortality studies are put here. I'll mention something about those a bit later on. But these were done by UNICEF, and UNICEF has done a marvelous job in Iraq at keeping activity going, keeping surveys going, and doing what it's supposed to do, is helping and being an advocate for women and children in development. Okay, in terms of reference on our missions, the sorts of things that we was, I put it here for the 97 mission, but basically it was the same terms of reference for 95, for all the missions. You have a group that involves agronomists, agriculturalists and others, so you look at agriculture. You have a group that are looking at the food supply, the food security, which is including the food ration and whether people are getting it. You have people looking at the prices of foods in the market, because this is a key feature of the availability to be able to meet your food needs, the extent of malnutrition, which was done by anthropometry, and we were able to go and weigh and measure children in households. We were able to select households in Baghdad. We were able to go in, weigh and measure children. And in 97, the 986, the Oil for Food program, just about started. It really didn't have any significant impact at that time, but we started looking at it. Okay, the inflation that took place in Iraq was enormous. Food prices have gone up. Now, how one is going to handle this in terms of the currency, this is a 100 dinar note. In 1990, a Iraqi 100 dinar note was worth $320. It was a strong currency. In 2003, you could get 2,400 Iraqi dinars for a dollar. 2,400. So prices have gone up many thousandfold. Food prices have gone up 4,000 to 5,000 times. Just imagine for a moment of a $1 hamburger is 3 years down the road is $3,000. Just imagine what that is going to do to any savings or any money that you had available anywhere, even if you had savings. And the people coped. There always is a coping mechanism. People coped by selling their resources to some degree. And you would see, I didn't see so much this time, but you would certainly see people in these little street markets selling their gold, selling their silver, selling their jewelry. Even in the hotel, there'd be a group of people selling stuff in, you know, to get people to sell their assets in order to buy food. So here we are going out to do our survey. This is from the Institute of Nutrition. This is, I think, the 95 mission. And we are going checking at the households. Can we come in and weigh and measure your children? And here we are weighing a child. Here we are taking the length of a child. Any of you that have ever taken the length of a child know that that kid is not in the proper way for having its length done properly. Head should be central, legs should be together, heels down, etc., etc. But you do have a measuring box, and you can weigh the weight, height, and age, and then you can do weight for height, height for age, and weight for height. Here's some of the data that we were getting in the 95 survey. I've always looked upon it, and in fact I've been on these surveys terribly naive. I believed that if you went to Iraq and you did a proper scientific evaluation, if you went there and you assayed the data according to the exact scientific criteria, that when you came back and reported on it, you would be believed. And someone would take notice of it. But in fact, no one took any notice. In fact, we were denigrated and told that basically we were making up some of these data, that we were not doing things the proper way, that we were sloppy with our work, etc., etc. In fact, that turned me from being a non-activist to an activist. When I realized that I was lied to by every government that I was living under, and the facts that I knew to be true were being denied, I became more of an activist than I ever intended to be. Anyway, let's point out some of the data here. As you know, if you do these data, you could measure the degree of wasting, the degree of stunting, and the degree of underweight. And if you're comparing with an international standard, as we were, the National Center of Health Statistics database, you would anticipate that there will always be 2 to 3% of children that are on the bell curve, that are 2 standard deviations away from the median. When you get levels that are much beyond 2 to 3%, you know then that you're getting a significant displacement and a significant degree of malnutrition. And in fact, prior to the sanctions, prior to 1990, children in Iraq were growing not very far off the Western growth standards. If anything, there was a slight degree of overweight in some of the under fives. We were getting in 1995, 30% of children, thereabouts, 29, were showing weight for age deficits. These are all those that are more than 2 standard deviations below the mean, the standardized way of defining malnutrition. And as many as 12%, which is quite a high figure, of children that were down in weight for height. And from 1989, Baghdad children were near normal weight for height. And this figure has moved down precipitously to data that is not far off sub-Saharan Africa. One of the most rapid declines in health standards in a short period that has ever occurred for a whole country. And to say, in one of the reports here, the high level of malnutrition that we documented in 95 were an important catalyst for the reaching of an agreement on the implementation of the Oil for Food program, which was implemented, signed in April 95, and actually the food didn't start flowing. The oil started flowing out in 96, but the food didn't start flowing in until 97. Okay, this is the statement that was made about it in the agreement in 1995. Serious nutritional health situation in the Iraqi population, and there was a risk of its deterioration. And the Oil for Food program was to be a temporary measure. Temporary existed until last week, or the week before. And this allowed equitable distribution of humanitarian relief to all segments of the Iraqi population. And, nice phrase here, with recognizing the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Iraq. That's a nice phrase to say there at the moment. So, this is the, again, these abbreviations that you have in the UN system. Everything is done with acronyms. MOU is a Memorandum of Understanding. SCR is Security Council Resolution. These are the, as it was, actually the figure has gone up from, this is 1 billion over 90 days, 4 billion a year. It's about 12 billion, or it was about 12 billion. But what I want to point out to you is that out of the money that comes from oil revenue, only about 40% of that money is able to be actually used for humanitarian supplies and food. The other is already earmarked for, and these proportions are approximately the same. 30% was reparations, which mainly went to already rich Kuwait. 5 to 10% was on pipeline repairs. 5 to 10% was for the UN in Iraq. And I'll show you in a moment pictures of all the nice new Toyotas that are supplied to the UN system. All those are paid for by Iraqi oil money. These are not UN money. They are not supplied by the UN. They are purchased by Iraqi oil revenues. And there also was almost twice as much available per capita for the North as there was for the South. And the Oil for Food program has been supplying food and humanitarian supplies to the North Kurdish area as well. Okay, here's some of the UN. Every one of those paid for from Iraqi oil money, and there's a degree. I noticed it. I began to feel sometimes embarrassed. You get carried up, you get taken around on these cars. You have a driver. One of the best jobs during sanctions Iraq, one of the best jobs you could have would be to be a UN driver. You could be a skilled engineer or an airline pilot or whatever. But if you got yourself a job as a UN driver, you were doing very well because you had access to foreign currency, and that made a huge, huge difference. But as I say, I would feel embarrassed. You'd be sitting in one of these, you'd be traveling along, you come to a checkpoint, there's all the Iraqi trucks and cars lined up, and the UN car zaps all the way around, pushes in up to the front, and you know, you begin to feel, and it's a very heady feeling. I can sort of see it, some of the youngsters that come in and find themselves being carried around in these UN cars, they begin to feel like kings in a very short time. And it shouldn't be that way. Okay, this is the food ration that has been, you would notice that the food ration is all dry or non-perishable foods. Basically flour, And the ration, the current ration, is not very different from the original design ration from the 1995-96. Flour, rice, sugar, tea, very important in the Iraqi situation, cooking oil, pulses, not always available in the early days, pulses, beans, peas, lentils of some sort, milk is put in brackets here, milk powder. This would only be available if there was a young child in the family. Milk normally was not available in the ordinary ration, though there has been some more recently. But the very, very important feature on this ration is not that it was making food available. It was doing that. But it was making food available at an affordable price. It was a subsidized food supply. You paid 105 Iraqi dinars in your local shop, and you in fact received per month 5,000 Iraqi dinars worth of food. So people were able to have the basic necessities of food at an affordable price when they had no work and no other things available. But this does not mean that that is a balanced nutritional food supply. It is missing, as all of you can see, minerals, vitamins, animal protein, etc. All these are available. The shops exist, the food exists, but if you need to have anything beyond your food ration, you pay for it at local food prices. So you're paying 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 times what it was 5-10 years earlier. Now, how does the food distribution system function? We've been hearing a bit about Umm Qasr, which has been taken over fairly early on. This was the major and only deep water port in the whole of Iraq, and the vast majority of food would come into Umm Qasr. Though there were food supply routes coming in from Turkey, there were food supply routes coming in from Jordan, and also from Syria, on the same road coming in. There were, and this was all set up by the Iraqi government in 1990 before the Oil for Food program. The Oil for Food program used the procedure that was functional from the Iraqi food rationing system. And spread around the country are a series of warehouses, large warehouses where the food would come in by truck. We visited, there's four, for example, in the Baghdad region, each one supplying about a million, million and a half people. There's one in the Basra region, and that's the one that was hit by some missiles just a week or so ago in the Basra region. And there are about 12 to 15 of these spread around the country, including one at Kirkuk, which was designed for the supply of food to this region, but also to the Kurdish autonomous region in Sulaymaniyah. There was one at Mosul, which would supply the Erbil and Dahuk regions of the north as well. So you have very big warehouses, the food comes in by truck, sometimes very long distance. I saw trucks here in Basra that had come down from Turkey, that had been delivering lentils and grain. So big warehouses. Then people come from the local food distribution centers, little local shops, of which there are 40 to 50,000 spread out the country. They come in, they get the food from the warehouse, they take it back, they distribute it, every person has a coupon, they supply the coupon, and then they get the food at that reduced price. local food shop will be something of this sort, where the food is available, you come in and your food is weighed out for you, the man has a balance, and is it. But at the same time, perfectly adequate food and vegetable supply, but most people cannot afford to purchase at the ordinary shops. There are some that do. There's always, in times of economic disruption, there are always those that win, the wheeler dealers that know how to find their way around, and shops are selling stuff to them. Actually, I looked very closely at this picture with a magnifying glass, and that is Johnny Walker whiskey up in the shelf. Here is the food ration as it occurred. Now, let me emphasize, the food rationing system started in 1990 purely under the Iraqi government. The Minister of Trade set this up, Mohammed Saleh, he set this up in 1990 in a very short period, a period of about 2 months. The whole thing was inaugurated and set up and functioned throughout the whole country. And he was Minister of Trade until presumably yesterday or the day before. I don't know. But he stayed Minister of Trade all the way through. He met with him. Each time I've been to Iraq, I have met with him. And we met with him in January again. But in those early days, between 1990 and 1995, Iraq was not allowed to sell its oil openly in the market. Certain amount of smuggling, there was a certain amount, but not too much. And therefore, gradually, as the period went on from 91 to 95, the ability of the government to be able to pay for the food ration diminished. And by 95, basically, they had to agree to the oil for food program. 96, some improvement, big improvement by the phases from 96, 7 onwards. Each of these phases is for 3 months, and by the time 2000, it was running at about 2,300. It was currently running just up until very recently, it was running at 2,450 calories. The food ration does not last very long. It is all dry food, therefore it is storable. And I told you, from October 2002, every person has been able to have double ration of food so that they could be stockpiling some of this because of the threat of the war. But we did this survey in 2000. Sugar, this is a month's supply. It lasts only 23 days. The wheat flour, about 3 weeks. The vegetable oil, about 3 weeks. Infant formula, about 3 weeks. But the more expensive and more desirable items in the food ration, the beans and peas, the legumes, that is, and the cheese when it was available, only last about a week. So they are very restricted in terms of animal foods and protein foods. Very, very restrictive diet. And as I say, buy stuff, but most people, 60% of the population, probably do not have enough money to be able to purchase food in the open shops. Some of the more obvious nutritional features. Yeah, I'm on time. Some of the more obvious nutritional features. Vitamin A deficiency can be extremely important, extremely significant, because it leads to blindness. Many of the doctors in the hospital said that they had seen vitamin A deficiency. I never saw any in any of the visits to any of the hospitals I made. I'm not saying it wasn't there, but I never managed to see it. I certainly saw kwashiorkor, I certainly saw marasmus, I certainly saw anemia, I certainly saw all the other diseases that were there, but I didn't see vitamin A, but it was reported. We certainly had anemia in women. We didn't have the ability to be able to thoroughly check it by doing hemoglobin. You can do the eye test just by pulling down the eyelid, and you can see the whiteness there and determine that you have it. We were recommending at that time that there should be some iron supplementation, but it never actually got inaugurated. But the most important feature has been the water and sewage situation, which is a relic from the Gulf War, amongst other things. Actually, at times when I think all the protests that we have been doing in the last few years have really been utterly futile, maybe not as futile as we think they are. In 1990-91, the aim of the American forces primarily was to destroy the infrastructure, and therefore electricity was targeted, as was water, sanitation, and we certainly were shown many of the water pumping stations and the sewage pumping stations that had been knocked out and have a setup which is what, maybe 8 pumps theoretically, and you only have 1 or 2 of them functioning at the time. But this time around, mainly I suppose because they realized they were going to go all the way, that if they knocked them out they would have to rebuild them, or someone would. Or perhaps the threats, because CESR made a definite threat when we were in Baghdad. They said they want the American government to recognize that if they do attack the water supplies, we will be citing them in the International Criminal Court. Not that they recognize the International Criminal Court, but that's another matter, for war crimes. So they have not gone ahead and targeted as blatantly as before. There certainly had been some targeting. In the South, many of the diseases that have been virtually eliminated in the period when Iraq had a very adequate healthcare system. There were hospitals in every major part of the country, mostly called Saddam Hospital, and almost identical buildings. You would come to a hospital in Amara, you'd come to a hospital in Mosul, you'd come to a hospital in Basra, and you know the pediatrics would be on the 7th floor, that the director's office would be round to the left as you come in through the main entrance, etc. These were all built mainly by British and Japanese contractors. Excellent hospitals with full facilities, all deteriorated since sanctions, where the piped oxygen no longer works and all those sorts of things. And diseases that have been overcome, typhoid, cholera, and infective hepatitis, are back. And many, many waterborne diseases occur, particularly in the South. It was particularly critical in Basra because in 1990 they had a whole new contracts there and contractors for the establishment of a completely new sewage system. There were whole chunks of this that could be dug up, pipelines put in which hadn't been connected to anything, and many of these have never been reconnected since then. So in Basra, as it was in 95, as it was in 2003, open sewers, people connect their toilets and things to these flow lines because there aren't any proper sewage. It's flat land, therefore you have to have pumps to pump the sewage away. You can't have very adequate drainage. If you do, it does drain and it's somewhere, but it stinks to my head. Open sewers in the middle of the streets, and particularly if you think of the climate of Basra in the south, in the Gulf area, temperatures reaching 45 to 50 centigrade, 125 or so Fahrenheit, and these things smell. And what you have too is backups. This looks as if it's just a puddle from rain. What this is because, if you think of how it happens, your drainage channels from the streets eventually connect up to the main sewage lines. If the pumps are not working, then in fact what happens is the sewage backs up and comes up in the street drains. And you would see here fecal material floating around coming up from the street drains because of the connection and the non-function. And here's a couple of the nice Toyotas that we were traveling around in. And say this is in Basra. And the situation 2 months ago was not very different from what it had been previously. Now, here's the mortality data. This is, again, an interesting set of data, and interesting also the way that it was released. But let me just explain the data first. The red line here is the estimated under 5 mortality rate from 1960 to 1990. The blue line is the infant mortality rate over the same period. Infant mortality, deaths per 1,000 live births, deaths under 1 year of age, and the 5 year is deaths under 5 years of age per 1,000 live births. As the country got richer, this in fact is the reverse of the picture that I showed on the calorie availability. As country got richer, calories went up. As country get richer, mortality rate declines. And there was a steady decline in both the under 5 mortality and the child mortality in 1990. Sanctions were imposed in 1990, and the mortality rate increased to 1995. And since then, we've had the oil for food program, and the very rapid increase has flattened off to some degree. And it is only just about now, 2003, began to really stabilize. What is interesting in terms of the sneaky way things are done, these data were collected by consultants from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, amongst others, working for UNICEF in Baghdad. And they did this study by standard procedures for estimation and talking about mortality data. UNICEF were not, it was suggested by UNICEF that they should not release this report in New York. The US government didn't want it released in New York and made it to be released in Baghdad, such that it would be rather more difficult for people to come across and to get hold of this data. So they didn't, you know, really hide it away, but it was an attempt at hiding it away to some degree. So, declines, increases, and from these calculations and data sets, UNICEF made the estimate here on the basis of the downward trends in mortality between 60 and 90. It has been estimated that some 500,000 excess deaths of children under the age of 5 may have occurred in the period from 1991 to 1998. And WHO made a separate estimate of 5,000 excess deaths per month taking place. These are established data by international agencies. And are shocking. And that we accept them. And Tony Blair had the audacity to come out a little while ago and talked about the deaths caused by sanctions as if they were caused by the Iraqi government, as if our imposing of sanctions wasn't anything to do with the effects that were occurring. And I just want to mention about my feeling about sanctions over the whole period. And often it has been denied that the sanctions are the cause of excess deaths, or that sanctions are the cause of increased malnutrition. On a world basis, we know that the major cause of malnutrition, the major cause, is poverty. This used to be just talked by red radicals 20, 30 years ago. We didn't mention poverty and nutrition in the same breath. Nutrition was science, poverty was economics and politics. But we know now that poverty is the cause of malnutrition on the world scale. Sanctions are defined as economic pain. Economic pain translates to artificial poverty. Therefore, it should not be any surprise at all that artificial poverty is just the same as real poverty and produces malnutrition and produces excess mortality. So I am firmly of the belief that the sanctions are the cause, and that our imposition of the sanctions has in fact been, some people would define it as a genocide. I don't think the term genocide fits, but certainly 500,000 deaths is 500,000 deaths. It's a lot. And we have done that to the Iraqi people. And the Iraqi people blame the United States for the deaths of their children. They blame them for the depleted uranium as the cause, which they take, this is their perception, that depleted uranium was not anything to do with weapons, it was to do with a weapon to kill their children. That was the perception that you get when you go into households. So the greater the poverty, the greater the prevalence of malnutrition, and hence more children die. And a nice quote here to almost finish from UNICEF. The ravages caused by malnutrition are preventable. The world is obligated to ease child malnutrition on the basis of international law, scientific knowledge, practical experience, and basic morality. I question when we come to international politics whether there is any basic morality whatsoever, but that is the phrase that is used. And all these things are going to take time. I want to put this into a time perspective and show one final slide, which has nothing to do with Iraq, except in the general sense. This is a cartoon from 1946. 1946, 60 years ago. And what this cartoon shows is this gentleman, Lloyd Boyd Orr, first Director General of the then newly founded Food and Agriculture Organization. And he was attempting to get the grain surpluses in the United States to the starving in the world. And there's a somebody trying to look at a textbook of economics as to how to do this and not quite understanding it. And the phrase goes, no dollars. That is the situation as it was in 1946. That is the situation for world malnutrition in 2003. And I'm afraid the way the world is moving is going to be the situation in 2046. Probably. So, in summary of some of the things that I've been saying, there's extensive malnutrition in the country. An extensive lack of education was taking place because of the deterioration in the education system. There is a fully functional, or there was a fully functional food distribution system. It doesn't need the UN. The food distribution system was being done by the Iraqi government. The UN were there, wasting an awful lot of money, in my view, to monitor this and to be there and to use the phrase that the US said, we must make sure that not a penny of the oil money gets through to Saddam. That was the phrase that was used, and the monitoring is done by the UN system. Every time that any food was distributed from a warehouse to a shop or the shop to the household, there would be a pair of monitors would be required to report on this, one international and one Iraqi. All this extra money involved, all being paid for out of Iraqi oil, and the whole country being maintained into poverty. There's a full food and distribution system, there's a full medical distribution system, there is full functionality on the UN system, and there was a press release just the day before yesterday from the director of UNICEF in Iraq in giving the press release in Jordan, mentioning that it is absurd the way that what is happening. We're getting all round the borders of Iraq at the moment. we're getting a whole group of non-government organizations like circling sharks around there trying to pick up humanitarian contracts from the US government from the military. They're all there waiting. Contracts are being given. Contracts are being given to evangelicals from the south. You get water if you get baptized, etc. And these sorts of things are going to be appalling if we are going to have that in the way that the whole humanitarian system is going to function. It works at the moment with the UN system and with the Iraqi government, but it is falling immediately into utter chaos, and contracts are being allocated seemingly under political patronage rather than under actual need. So that's all I've got to say, and I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Yeah. Well, I just have a question. Why is it an organization like UNICEF would go to all that trouble and then not make sure that the information wasn't made available?
Oh, it was made available. The report was released in Baghdad. You could get it through Baghdad.
I know, but that's clearly a deception. I mean, something a little more honest.
Well, I'm afraid, and I've come across this with my experience of the UN system. I'll give an anecdote of that a little. Well, but the UN system run scared all the time. They are almost completely dependent for their funding on the United States. Let me just give an example. It just happened just a few weeks ago. The invasion is illegal in international law. There have been no actions taken by the UN as such to declare it illegal. Kofi Annan actually sent round a message that UN people should not protest. They should not be permitted to protest against the illegal actions of the United States. I will give an example from our 2000 mission. When you go and do a mission for the UN, you go to Rome for FAO, and you have what's called briefing before and debriefing afterwards. Just about in before 2000, end of 99, the UN system decided on a component which they were calling human rights in development. And it was supposed to be that there should be a framework of human rights should be used for every developmental project. So we met with the FAO people in Rome, and in my naive way, I said, well, we've just seen this statement about human rights framework. Perhaps we ought to develop our mission this time around on a human rights framework. And the people at the sort of level of the meeting we were at were all very enthusiastic. Yes, we had been told to use human rights as this framework. Let us do it. Next morning, I was hauled up to the Deputy Director General of the FAO, top floor of Building A, carpeted and all that stuff, and I was essentially told that it would be inappropriate to use human rights of the Iraqi people as part of the mechanism of doing a FAO report, because each of the UN agencies is so dependent on the US for its funding that they run scared all the time. It's sad, but that's the way it functions.
Well, who is UNICEF dependent on for funding?
UNICEF is less dependent, but they also have the perception that they are doing their own partial fundraising, and particularly in the United States, if they're perceived as being in the pocket of Baghdad in any way, they're going to have difficulty in raising money. The way the world actually works, the closer I've got to these upper levels of international politics, the more disgusted I have become in the way that the reality is compared to the way we'd like it to be.
Well, it must be kind of discouraging for someone like UNICEF. I mean, it seems to mute their whole point.
Well, they're able to do a lot of work. I mean, they've done an extremely functional activity. They have kept going all the way through with the Baghdad office, dealing with women and children's issues, weighing and measuring children, dealing with water sanitation issues, etc. FAO, they've all been doing the same. But there's a tremendous degree of political maneuvering that goes on. For example, I didn't mention this, to do with the various parts of the way the oil for food contract works. I think I told you that the money has to go to the Iraqi government, does not get its hands on its oil money. That goes to a Bank of Paris account, and then there are contracts that are done under what's called the 661 committee. There's a tremendous degree of manipulation that goes on and rather dirty little games that go on. Ensuring, for example, and the US has been mainly to blame, US has been involved in 92% of all the contracts that have been blocked by the US. Ensuring that even when a contract is done, the thing doesn't get through, and that even when Iraq has paid money, it doesn't get the humanitarian supplies that it should do. Sprays, sprayers, and the spray will not arrive at the same time. They will come differently, so therefore neither can go ahead, and you can't do a malaria control program, because when eventually it does come, it is out of date, and the time has passed and it's been stored. And then they give leaks to Barbara Crozet in the New York Times to go and look at the storage in the warehouses, saying Saddam is storing all this stuff. I mean, it's dirty.
It's dirty, all right.
And I'm sickened at times.
Any questions?
I'm curious about the agricultural, the lack of agriculture that you're talking about. I mean, there are great rivers through all of Iraq, and the valleys that those create. I mean, I feel like there could be more agriculture.
Oh, there ought to be more. There certainly is some, and again, that gets tied up into politics. FAO made big recommendations that a good deal of the marshland area that is in the southern part of Iraq should be drained and turned into agricultural land. And a part of this was done. And I was actually taken to one of these by the Minister of Irrigation. And it was almost like a school or a university graduation. They had got this new land area that was available from having been drained from the marshland, and the water was then flowing out to the Shatl Arab. And they were handing out certificates of ownership to the people in the area for new agricultural land. And I saw it actually happening, but we have condemned that as being destruction of the way of life of the marsh Arabs. You know? But it's a very, very harsh climate in the south. Iraq is, yes, it's got the Tigris and Euphrates. Yes, you can see growth all the way along within a few miles either side of the river. But once you get out into the desert land, it is extremely harsh, extremely high summer temperatures. And only when you get up to the north do you have somewhat more hilly land and somewhat more adequate agricultural conditions. That's why 48% of agricultural land is in that 9% of the land area. Certainly agriculture has to be done. FAO have been working very hard on this, but it is so much easier to purchase food on the world market, or it has been, particularly when you've got oil wealth. Yeah.
You've mentioned that there's, or you drawn a quote from someone who said that there are sort of this shark-like circle of NGOs who are waiting to get humanitarian contracts. Could you explain a little bit how those contracts work, and also
don't know at the moment. We, as part of our report in
earlier this year, try to emphasize in the same way that the UNICEF director is emphasizing, that when you've got a fully functional system that is in place, you don't have to restart and have all sorts of food delivery contracts. The idea is that the various non-government organizations, some of them with evangelical connections, some without, would get contracts from the military to come in and deliver food to here, or deliver medicines to there, or do various types of, where the full system is and has been fully functioned through the Iraqi government. But that's going to be probably thrown out, and these other people are going to come in. Halliburton is one that's got some of the contracts already. And again, that apparently is one of the things where Blair is arguing with Bush, if he does, if the puppy dog does argue at all, I don't know.
And these are all external organizations?
Yes,
and
yes.
Are there any?
And many, and there's a lot of worry as to whether some of these will be direct contracts with the military. And as soon as you start mixing together food and humanitarian along with the military, you're running into huge, huge problems. But that seems to be, and there's a great deal of insensitivity at that level. Yeah?
This might be a silly question, but I noticed when you were explaining what was involved in the food rations, salt wasn't given, and it seems to me if they'd given salt and sugar, then people could make oral rehydration solution.
Yeah.
If they needed to, so I was wondering why salt wasn't part of the
ration. I think salt may have been, maybe I didn't list it on the ration there. I think some salt is there, but they certainly could do the oral rehydration. Certainly the local clinics do make these recommendations. But the malnutrition is almost always water related. And many of these things, except where UNICEF has been delivering them, UNICEF and WHO, have not always been available. You go into a pharmacy of a hospital, and the amount of material they have would be really very negligible. And all sorts of key problems occur. Calazar is a child disease, an adult disease as well, leishmaniosis, that has come back. It's borne by a sandfly. And kids are dying of this at the moment. We saw several in the hospitals. But the drug is a protozoal, an antiprotozoal, and is not available. It's on the banned list as far as things that can be imported into Iraq. I mean, the sanctions, the way it actually functions, has been appalling. I mean, we always talk that we like free enterprise and we don't like bureaucracy, and we set up a completely bureaucratic system of these contracts just to ensure that none of the money is able to be used by the Iraqi government at all, except for what goes through on these contracts. Yeah.
You said that that most of the local people weren't able to afford the food in the markets,
mm-hmm.
but then I see in the picture like a guy in a suit tie and things. What is the population that can afford the food?
Again, we did some rough estimates of this. Certainly, sanctions are a very, very blunt instrument indeed. They affect most often and most completely the poor and the vulnerable. They do not affect the military, they do not affect the elite, they do not affect those that have got contracts and doing wheeling and dealing. All sorts of that can go on. We saw tires being smuggled in, even the taxi we were driving in was smuggling some tires. Certainly you can load up a truck with wheat and sell that across into Iran or into Saudi Arabia. You can get dollars for it instead of the Iraqi currency and exchange that back again. These wheeler dealers, probably 10%. 70% of the population is heavily affected by the sanctions. Mainly the previous workers, previous. It was a semi-socialist economy in the school teachers, doctors, and others were all employed by the state. And all of those, their salaries have gone up maybe tenfold, and prices gone up 2,000-fold. So they're extremely poverty. So 70% of the population heavily affected, 10% not affected at all, and got very rich in between. And a few in the rural areas have done somewhat better than those in the urban areas. If you're in a rural area and you've got a bit of farmland, even if your crop has to be sold to the government, you can still have a few sheep, you can still have a few chickens, you can still grow some little bit on the side. So the rural area has done somewhat better.
You talked about how the water and sewage situation was very bad. Has that deteriorated since 1990, or was it always bad? Yeah. So what are the reasons behind
this? Well, one of the reasons is the lack of being able to get contracts to refurbish it. Many of the things were put down and called dual use items. Big mechanical moving equipment. While it can be used for putting in sewage lines, it also could be considered as being used for digging trenches for troops. So therefore, these were not allowed under the sanctions. So Iraq would ask to have the equipment available and wouldn't be allowed to have it. The spare parts, chlorine is needed for the dealing of the water supply. That again is limited and only can be imported through UNICEF. All sorts of reasons. And then, of course, on top of all that, there's been the gradual deterioration that was taking place over time as well. So instead of it getting better, you've got a continuous deterioration over time, and it was getting worse. The sewage system in Baghdad was cracking, built 50, 60 years ago, and then that was breaking up. So you're getting mixtures between groundwater and sewage water and water supply. You know, all sorts of things. People's houses would flood with sewage. Lots and lots of problems like that. And the country, we use on the second sheet there, we use the analogy that the whole country is not unlike a vast refugee camp. People are limited in their food availability, they're limited in what they can do, there is very little work available, there's no development available, and people's horizons are very, very limited. And, no wonder they're in a terribly depleted state. And, this is set up as a war. It always is the way you do it. You only make sure you have a war against people that you know you can beat easily.
I know that there's a lot of discrimination against women in Iraq.
No, there isn't.
There's not?
No. It hasn't been. No, it has been one of the few secular states in the Middle East where there has been relatively.
I'm talking about Afghanistan.
Oh, okay. Afghanistan, yes. Saudi Arabia, yes. Iraq has had a educated elite available in education. Women. It has been a secular state. Therefore, in fact, far from being a place with Bin Laden being a supporter of Iraq, he doesn't like a secular state. And Iraq has been a secular state. Say, full opportunities for women. You can have a woman wandering around with a veil, you can have a woman without the veil. You see a pair of girls walking together arm in arm, one with a veil, one without, you know. That's certainly not, you can't put that on his plate. He's demonized enough without putting that in him as well.
Going back to the UN and its organization, I was just wondering how it is that the U.S. has come to wield so much power over the UN. Is it purely on account?
Purely on account of wealth and strength. Those two go together. And you know that if you... how does it happen? Let's give you an exact concrete example. James Baker in 1991. I think it was 1990. James Baker was the Secretary of State then. And there was a vote that was to go ahead with the then Gulf War. And Yemen voted against. James Baker said out loud, that's the most expensive vote you're ever going to make. And they cut off foreign aid, bang like that. So it is done by cutting off direct aid. It is done by ensuring that the next time that World Bank contract comes up, we won't be supporting you. Next time there's an IMF loan around, we won't be supporting you. And also the other side of the coin, watch it. Look what we can do to Iraq. We destroyed Iraq over the sanctions over the years. If you don't watch it, it'll be happening to you as well. It's dirty business up there. Yeah.
I read in an editorial commentary that you wrote in 1998 that the oil for food hasn't really been as effective as it could. And I was wondering if you were referring to the kind of distribution of funds going to various things, or if you were referring to accountability or...
No, I think that the way that it has worked in terms of the functioning in Iraq has been very good. We had two assistant director generals that have resigned on account of the effect of the sanctions. Dennis Halliday resigned and Hans von Spanning resigned. My main critique of the Oil for Food program has been that it has concentrated too much on the food and hasn't permitted the development of the water sanitation sector to be improved. And it is only recently, up until 2000, we were still getting either a static or a slight decline in the health of Iraqi children. Since 2000, a survey in 2003 has shown somewhat of an improvement. So there has been inputs into the water sector, but it is the fact of oil for food. Malnutrition in children is much more in water sanitation sector than it is in the food alone. And so despite expectations that as soon as this came into play we would be getting malnutrition declining, we didn't get it. It's taken 4 or 5 years before it has started to move up again. But it was moving up. Survey done this last year, UNICEF in 2002. Showed an improvement since 2000. Yeah.
I have a question, not really related to nutrition, but it's sort of anyway. Do you believe that after the US-led coalition, this is over, do you believe that the problem related to what you're talking about in Iraq these days is going over because of what's
been happening? Well, I frankly have no idea what is going to happen. Certainly something has to be done in terms of the prevention of a humanitarian disaster from the population as a whole. But I would be terribly afraid of a system of suddenly privatizing everything. You look what happened in Russia, where everything was privatized. We've got a population that is virtually destitute with very little income. We've got a currency that is highly lost its value. And if suddenly we say, oh, we don't need any of these food distribution things, let's just have a free and open market, free for all, we're going to have a whole massive sector of the population that are going to be affected. And I'm scared of the dual ideologies that we have in this administration. The religious fundamentalism associated with the free market lot all going together. But I do not expect to see any happy outcomes. But that's a personal viewpoint. I might be proven wrong, I hope I am, for the poor Iraqi people.
Any more questions?
Well, you've mentioned water a few times. What is the situation in terms of drinking water? I mean, I assume pretty bad.
Oh, it's pretty bad. In Basra, for example, there are water stations. The ordinary water pipes are cracked and broken, and the sewage is mixing in, so therefore your water is contaminated. Much of the standard drinking water that is available from the ordinary sources is highly saline. It can be used for certain purposes, but certainly can't be used for drinking. And so you will go to a local thing like a small gas station and be able to purchase drinking water, which is done by reverse osmosis and is palatable. Certainly every time I've been there, we have been warned and not to use tap water for any drinking purpose. You turn on the hotel room tap in Baghdad just a month or two ago, and you get a lot of brown stuff coming out first, and then water. Certainly you shouldn't trust that. Is bottled water available at a very high price? Bottled water is 4 times the price of gasoline. There was a time when I was waiting for the UNICEF car to be filled up with gas at the gas station, and I did some little calculations. At that time, the gasoline was highly subsidized, and they hadn't changed the pricing. But at that particular time, with the inflation that had gone on and the subsidized price of gasoline, you could get 2,000 gallons for a dollar. U.S. exchange rate.
Yeah. I'm wondering about the folks up at the UN, if they're all as corrupt.
No, I'm not saying they're corrupt. They're running scared.
Okay, so are their hands authentically tied, or do they play the game like the United States? In other words, if they were in the power of the United States, would they be playing the same game, or are there some authentically grounded people?
I mean, all the people that I know in the UN system are very... They're dedicated, they want to do what they can. But they know the limitations, and they know that when people are outspoken, they get moved up. Let's give another example. Hans von Sperling, I mentioned his name, humanitarian coordinator of the UN system in Iraq. 30-year German diplomat to the UN system, etc. Very dedicated. You know, for the last 10 years, we, that is Britain and the US, have been bombing Iraq all the time in what we call no-fly zones. They're not UN no-fly zones. They are US, UK, and at one time France, but no longer. And there have been damage caused. People have been killed. There have been casualties. And Iraq reports them, and the data gets disseminated away. Hans von Sperling decided that this was happening sufficiently. He was humanitarian coordinator. Therefore, he would send a team to go whenever there was one of these things was reported, that a missile had gone astray or whatever, that he would send someone there to check up on it. And they found that most of the time, the Iraqi reports were correct, and the US and UK denials were incorrect. Guess what happened? Hans von Sperling got requested to resign. Mm.
And how well known was the reason for that in the UN?
It's well known amongst those of us that know, but on the outside, well, just propaganda.
So why isn't there like a general, you know, some sort of a revolution against that?
It's, you know, people are dedicated on the whole, but they know their job is online. We are beginning to get that way here now. There was someone at the Columbia University made some sort of statement, and there was a group of Republican senators who decided to target him and say that he shouldn't have made any statement like that. This was unpatriotic, etc. Okay. Yeah, that's the way it works, and it's beginning to happen here.
Well, you know, I mean, in a situation like that, it seems to me like these intelligent UN people should recognize that a situation like this can't get better. It can only get worse. As long as dishonesty is paid for and they have to comply with it, it can't get better.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to get worse. So eventually, they're going to get screwed one way or another. So it just seems to me we should have a little more
There's a technical agency saying, well, we're technical agencies, yes, we can do this, we will do our little technical job and forget about the politics of it. But, you know, when the Secretary General can come up with an illegal operation and say, you must not, as a UN person, must not protest, where are we at?
Crazy.
I'm retired. And I am a full professor. I don't have any of those things, so I'm happy enough to say things now. But I know the threats. I mean, I know that was not, and I was still, you know, will what I say upset the UMass people? I better turn that down a little bit, etc. It happens easily. Yeah.
I don't know the extent or details regarding the sanctions, but I expect that Iraq probably can't apply to the World Bank or something for developmental loan. But has there been any kind of UN organization that's tried to go in and
the
situation?
The UN per se, even though it is the group that is enforcing the sanctions, the UN per se has never undertaken an investigation. Various of the technical agencies, like FAO, have done so. And again, let's hold the FAO thing worked again. They would send a team to Iraq to investigate the effect of sanctions. Mostly, this would be independent consultants to FAO. They would not be FAO personnel. So therefore, FAO would be in a position. Well, we sent the consultants, that's what they said. We didn't say it.
Thank you so much for your presentation.
Help yourself.